Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of vanityfair.com, and I'm here today with the entire crew. We have our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hello.
Our film critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
So it's a funny period in the summer where there's not really a lot coming out right now that is, likely to be awards contender. The Emmy nominations are already out. Dunkirk is in theaters. We can talk about the awards prospects of the Emoji Movie, but no one I know has seen it, so it just seems unfair. But interestingly enough, there is a lot of stuff on the horizon. So without a new release this week to kind of eye, we're going to look ahead a little bit and then talk about some broader topics in the news right now. But to start with, Richard, you have seen two recent and sort of close upcoming movies that seem pretty interesting, and you have reviews of both of them on VF.com now. So tell us about, I guess, Logan Lucky first and then Detroit.
Yeah, Logan Lucky is the new movie from Steven Soderbergh, who had sworn he was done with feature film directing.
Yeah, I thought
directing.
He was not making movies anymore.
Yeah, no, he's
back.
Yeah.
No one ever keeps those promises. Yeah, it's not fair. It's just a fake way to get
it's
publicity.
It's why when everyone was freaking out about Daniel Day-Lewis, it was like, all right, he said this before, is probably, he'll be back.
And Daniel Craig, by the way, is coming back as James Bond after saying basically he'd rather slit his wrist, so they're just cranky. Creatives are cranky.
If you're paid enough to pay James Bond, I think you just do it.
And by the way, this is my last episode on the podcast.
Mike's retiring.
Sorry to tell you.
But yeah, so he's back in making feature films, and it's very familiar. It's basically an Ocean's 11 story, but set in sort of Appalachia, West Virginia, and North Carolina, about a bunch of kind of ne'er-do-well sort of hickish people who rob a NASCAR event because there's a ton of cash that flows through these things. And so it's all about them rigging up the heist, and it's got an all-star cast. Channing Tatum, Adam Driver, Katie Holmes is in it, Hilary Swank is in it. It's just a ton of people similar to Ocean's 11.
The casting is so amazing. It's like for a hick movie, heist movie.
Yeah.
That is great casting. Like Hilary Swank, just bring back the police, don't cry, Hilary Swank. Yeah.
Or Adam Driver. Dollar baby, for that matter.
Yeah, exactly. And aren't they both, they're supposed to be Iraq War veterans, Adam Driver and Channing?
Adam Driver is, yeah.
Oh, okay. Isn't Channing too, or no?
No.
Okay.
He's kind of like the screw-up brother, and Adam Driver is the one who was good, but then lost a limb in the war.
And Adam Driver really did go fight in Iraq, didn't he?
He almost did. He injured himself before he deployed.
Okay, thank you.
It's a fun movie. While it's heavy on star power, and obviously Soderbergh is a lauded Oscar-winning director, this is not. This is a late summer kind of fun thing that I enjoyed. I think that there could be some itchiness with the way these wealthy Hollywood actors depict poorer Southern-ish people, especially given the fact that we have between Catherine Waterston, who's in the movie, Riley Keough, who's in the movie, and Jack Quaid, the son of Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan. We have three celebrity scions who are playing these sort of Southern twanged, hicky characters, and it's like, ugh.
Yeah, but Riley Keough's
really so good.
Grandfather is Elvis.
Right, right.
So, he's the king of the hicks.
Yeah, true. That's true. That is a good point. And she's wonderful in the movie, as she is in most things. She kind of does walk off with her scenes. She plays their sister, Channing Tatum and Adam Driver's sister. Yeah. So it's a fun movie. It's a nice respite from other kind of popcorn fare this summer that's all things blowing up and whatnot. It's a very sort of lo-fi kind of heist movie.
I haven't seen the movie yet, but I had reported to me that at one point, I think they call themselves Ocean 7-Eleven or something like that, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. So I was watching the movie. I saw it actually kind of a while ago, and I was watching it and sort of like writing, you know, either headlines in my head or review sentences in my head, and I was like, oh, like, you know, make the kind of Ocean's 11 comparison. Like, that's an easy layup, and then they do it for you in the movie. So
yeah.
So it's a weird world where they acknowledge that Ocean's 11 exists. Yeah, so it's a fun time.
What do you feel like this is as a Soderbergh comeback? Like, does it surprise you that this is the way he chose to come back? But is it more like he's the guy who most recently made Magic Mike? Of course it happened this way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the same with Quentin Tarantino in a way, where I long for Quentin Tarantino to make a movie that has some thought and heft behind it, some sort of, you know, emotional register to it. But, you know, if he wants to make the movies he wants to make, then that's his prerogative. Same with Soderbergh. Soderbergh has made, I mean, I think Traffic is probably his most, you know, intensely serious movie. But, you know, I think that he just kind of wants to make these fun movies between, Side Effects was supposed to be his last feature film, and that's this really fun kind of dark thriller with Rooney Mara and Channing Tatum. He did Behind the Candelabra for HBO, which has some pathos to it, certainly. But yeah, he's back with this, and while I might have hoped for something with a bit more weight to it, a bit more scale, he's really good at doing this kind of thing, and so why the heck not if he wants to do it?
Can I ask you one last question? Since you, like me, care a lot about accent work, I have had some question marks about what Daniel Craig is doing in the trailers. Does it work overall, his thing?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, he's good in the movie. His character is kind of fun. He plays this convict named Joe Bang, who they need to get out of prison to help them with the heist and then get back into prison so they don't know that he escaped for a day. It's a really fun setup the way they do that. So his character's fun, but you know, in the way that some British actors can actually really do a Southern accent well because it's closer to a British accent than, you know, a sort of mid-Atlantic American accent is, he struggles with it a little bit, yeah. But it's not so bad that it's distracting.
I mean, there have been worse Southern accents from actual Americans, so I guess we can't get on this case too much.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah. But Richard, if you're looking for something weighty and meaningful, I hear Kathy Bigelow has a new movie too.
She does. So this is her follow-up to Zero Dark Thirty. Same screenwriter, Mark Boal. It's called Detroit. Largely, it's about the Detroit riots, but in a more specific sense, it's about an incident that happened at the Algiers Motel 50 years ago on Tuesday, it was the 25th, where three black young men were shot and killed in a sort of police raid situation that, depending on who you believe, and you know, I sort of tend to err on the side of believing the victims rather, or the people who are subject to it rather than the corrupt police force. It was a real sort of horror movie kind of execution style situation. So she depicts that in this movie, Bigelow does, with sort of an unflinching eye, and it just goes and goes and goes. And it's sort of a horror movie for the second act mostly. And then the third act, they kind of go into the justice aspect of it, or the lack of justice. And then it sort of ends on this, not at all hopeful note, but a sort of grace note of really humanity that's, I think, kind of rare for Bigelow. So yeah, it's pretty powerful, but I think it will not be without its fair share of controversy.
I mean, obviously you are a white person. You're not maybe the best to weigh in on this, but like, how do you think it's going to fare with the why are white people telling this story question?
Well, you know, I did something that I hope it was transparent enough in my review where I just sort of asked that question at the end. And I was like, the honest answer is, I don't know. It will take a lot more people talking about this movie, seeing this movie, to really sort of figure this out. I think they do a good job with the material. I think that it's treated seriously, and I think they give focus to the right stories within, or smaller stories within this larger narrative. But what would the film look like if it was made by a black director, if it was written by a black writer? Might there have been certain sensitivities, certain nuances? I think there certainly would be, but this is not a story that had yet been told. And so I think it's a good thing that it is being told. And, you know, Bigelow, while she may have her flaws, especially in terms of the way that Zero Dark Thirty handled torture, she is a thoughtful, thorough director. And I think that she handles the story with a sort of the right amount of soberness. It's not a lot of editorializing. It's just, you know, until the end, sort of, she's just saying this is what happened, and this, or the way, what we believe happened. And so if you're going to have a white director do it, I think that you could do certainly a lot worse than her.
Is it just a nightmare to watch?
It's horrible.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really like, I sat next to a fellow critic, friend of the podcast, David Sims, and he had just like his hands like on his face, just like in sort of shock for a good hour of the movie, as did I. So it's not like a fun August, you know, thing. I don't really understand why it's coming out when it is. Maybe the fall just seemed too crowded, but I think it is, depending on how people it's received. The reviews were mixed, I would say, positive to mix. It could be in sort of awards contention for various things.
Best picture?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, depending on what the response is. I mean, because it's coming at a pretty urgent time, you know.
Well, I mean, certainly, it's relevant to a lot of big debates happening right now.
Yeah.
And acting award nominees?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of good. John Boyega is in it, and has, he's great. He doesn't. He's sort of playing this pretty even keel. He just wants to follow the rules, kind of characters, keep his head down. And so he's great. And there's this somewhat new newcomer named Algie Smith, who plays an aspiring singer who is part of a real life group called the Dramatics that had a few hits out of Motown in the 60s and 70s. And so he plays this young guy who gets tangled up in this, and he's really good, and he sings and he emotes, and it's a really strong performance from someone who I don't know that I'd seen in anything before. Algie Smith is his name. So great performances. Will Poulter, who's this British actor who you've seen in We're the Millers and various other things, he plays this villainous cop who is sort of a composite character, I think, or at least they changed his name because, again, these cops got off for this, and so they couldn't quite name them outright. Anyway, he plays this villain, and it's a really effective villain performance, even though you really hate him.
He was supposed to play the clown in the new It movie. Do you think this is a scarier role?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because it's 90% real, 95% real. So yeah, I mean, it doesn't feel cartoonish in terms of its villainy, really. It might if you didn't know it was a real story, but if you go in knowing that, it's mostly just scary.
Not having seen either of these movies, I just personally wish like Mark Boll and Catherine Bigelow would make an Appalachian problematic heist movie, you know, once in a while, just to kind of like let some of the air out of the room and loosen up their joints. But hey, okay.
Well, Catherine Bigelow also, you know, has directed some great action movies like Point Break. And it's just, I think it's great that this story is being brought to a major feature film. I think it bears telling. But in a similar way, we talked about last week with the Benioff and Weiss show about an alternate America where slavery still exists. It's like, okay, well, but why you? Like, what, you know, why is this what you wanted to do? And there are moments in Detroit where there's a little bit of a hint of like, there's a kind of prurient quality to it where it's like, okay, are we just doing a thriller horror movie? I mean, this is about something serious and real. And maybe a black director and a writer would have treated it with a little bit less. It's not titillating exactly, but it borders on it sometimes.
Or had permission to not be so serious about it either. I don't know,
but I think these questions are all kind of why at the end I was sort of in writing about the movie was forced to say I don't know. And I think that what I'm really interested in, and maybe it's a cop-out when writing a review, but what I'm really interested in is hear what other people think about it, you know. I can say my little piece about it, but I'll be very eagerly reading, you know, the conversation and following it, because I could tell just for when the reviews came out, just like searching Twitter for just the phrase, you know, Detroit reviews, there are a lot of people who are really anticipating this movie. A lot of them are black, and they were expressing, you know, excitement or disappointment. And so obviously this is a movie that means a lot to a lot of people, and I'm really curious to hear what they have to say about it versus me, you know, seeing the movie at 10 a.m. on a Friday morning and for a work assignment. You know, it's a different experience. So.
That's a good takeaway, I think.
I mean, without like an audience really having seen it, it's kind of hard to say what the lasting impact is going to be. But it feels to me like opening this in August is kind of a way to keep it away from some of the scrutiny that Zero Dark Thirty got. Like if it opens not in a typical awards window, it's going to be treated a little bit differently. Like maybe they don't want it to be around for 8 months to have people tear it apart the way they did Zero Dark Thirty. Or do you see it hanging in there?
It really depends. I think that, you know, this August release slot, you know, where it's, you know, with the help slot or whatever. I mean, this is so far from the help, it's not even funny, but like, you know, this sort of late summer release that could hold on until Oscars, which some movies have, but some movies certainly haven't. It's tricky to say. I think that it could resurface later in the season if it's handled the right way.
I gotta say, it's been a kind of grim summer at the movies. I miss like the Ricky and the Flash and the Help and even the Butler. Like, when can we get like our August Oscar movies to be like a little fun?
Or Florence Foster Jenkins or something.
Oh my God. Yeah. What a wonderful time that was.
But then again, the blockbusters have been pretty great, surprisingly great and fun.
But grim. So. I mean, I think we talked about this last week, that Wonder Woman, you know, you have The Front in World War One, and you've got War for the Planet of the Apes. I mean, I guess Spider-Man
Homecoming, man.
Yeah. Not one of the blockbusters that I think we'll see again in Oscar season, but
probably not.
Well, that's like not a bad transition to Dunkirk.
Yeah.
Speaking of serious movies.
Yeah, so Mike, you weren't with us to talk about Dunkirk last week. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I watched it last night.
What'd you think?
Well, I'm glad that Bane got to fly a plane. I think that was really good of them.
Didn't he crash a plane in The Dark Knight Rises? Wasn't that the opening of that movie?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just like,
parachutes out of a crashing
plane. Is it Nolan or is it Hardy that's like, no, I think like a mask and a weird voice would be really great for all roles that we collaborate on.
He has such a lovely voice, too. Like, his normal speaking voice is so charming that it's weird that you just can never hear it.
And the two guys, without spoiling anything, two pilots are on the radio, and one of them you can hear his voice perfectly, and then anytime Tom Hardy speaks, it's like... It's weird. Over now. oh, it's like, what is happening here?
I want to eat some crow about what I said last week when Richard was talking about Dunkirk, and I thought it would do really well at the box office, and Valerian was going to crash and burn. And I was like, I don't know. People are excited about Valerian. But of course, Richard was right. I saw Valerian. I understand why people didn't go see it now. It's beautiful, but like the plot is just abysmal. But I just wanted to be forthright with how wrong I was. And
we have accountability on this podcast.
Thank you for that. We will not erase for coming the past. Clean. But no, I think that it's certainly an experience. It's intense. There's a lot of time. I'm glad I had gone to the beach before watching the movie rather than after. but I don't know. It's an interesting thing. We were emailing before the show about the kind of the serious capital war, capital movies at the Oscars. It's been a while. I guess Catherine Bigelow's the last one who won Best Picture full on with The Hurt Locker. I mean, this thing feels like it could definitely be a Best Picture nominee, and Nolan's obviously been nominated before. I guess it resonates with our time in terms of like, wow, what a healthy, in some way, society dealing in a healthy way with an incredible setback versus our incredibly pathetic, narcissistic society that's imploding even though everything is great for our people. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's going to be the big resonant takeaway. But I don't know. I feel like you need to like ride something. If you're going to win Best Picture, you got to be riding something with a movie like this.
Well, there's only about 5 minutes, if that, at the very end of the movie that one could call sentimental. And I think that even a movie as brutal and annihilating as Hacksaw Ridge had, you know, the first half is this kind of like righteous, like conscientious objector story. And then the last part of Hacksaw Ridge is like, you know, Jesus kind of stuff like that.
Right.
Dunkirk does not allow for that kind of sentiment to seep in really. And so I wonder if it will have the emotional pull that, you know, your sort of typical voter is looking for.
That's true. It's not a heartstringer at all. Really.
I think that it's intellectually stirring, and you sort of. I was moved by it, but I wasn't like.
Well, do you think
carried
he's
away.
Banking on you're in so much? You're so like anxious the entire time that payoff maybe is more. But I don't know. I mean, I was a little emotional, but yeah.
That reminds me of Captain Phillips, which I thought was really powerful at the end there. Where
yes.
You kind of are so tense the entire time, and then Tom Hanks kind of breaks down, and you just feel this rush of emotion with him. But remember, Tom Hanks didn't get nominated for Best Actor for that. So weird things happen.
And yeah, and that really did like get to me in a way that the ending of this, it was moving, but it wasn't like that moment. That moment's like you just fall apart watching Tom Hanks in that moment. I mean, it's funny if you look back, Bridge of Spies lost to Spotlight 2 years ago. American Sniper lost to Birdman, which is still sort of bizarre. Zero Dark Thirty lost to Argo, which is also a war movie, but doesn't have that kind of high seriousness.
Yeah, you know? That's sort of more of an espionage kind of thing.
Right. War Horse lost to The Artist. Again, sort of okay. And in 1998, maybe the weirdest one of all, Saving Private Ryan and The Thin Red... Well, Saving Private Ryan. The Thin Red Line, which is a great movie, but maybe more like this one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like just so kind of intellectual and not pulling the heartstrings. But they both lost to Shakespeare in Love, which was sort of like Harvey's original sort of...
coup.
Pulled out the thing that nobody could believe. So I don't know. But on the other hand, The Hurt Locker won in 2009. You have Schindler's List, Platoon, The Deer Hunter, Patton, Lawrence of Arabia, The Bridge on the River Kwai. But I don't know. You know, a lot of those are, they have humor. They have a lot of kind of character work. This thing has, there's character work, but it's, there's not like funny set pieces or anything like that. It's all,
there's the musical number, but that.
And Harry Styles is kind of like, is this a spoiler to say he's kind of a jerk? Can I say that?
No, I don't think that's a spoiler.
Okay.
But is he good at being a jerk?
Yeah. He's very good.
Yeah. I mean, no one really gets a ton of like opportunity to act, the capital A act. It's very hurried and sort of overwhelmed.
The sound designer basically is the star of the movie and the cinematographer.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this is something I talked about last week too, but like, I wonder if the Britishness of the story, I mean, it's very British. I wonder if that is any impediment to doing well. I mean, it'll probably do well at the BAFTAs for sure, but you know, a lot of war movies that have been honored at the Oscars, you know, over the years, and there have been many, are American stories, and I wonder what that means for Dunkirk, though well-reviewed and well-received as it has been.
When I got out of Dunkirk, I tweeted something along the lines of, like, it just felt so patriotic. It, like, you know, made me want to be British, basically. And Guy Lodge, who's a critic and a friend of some of ours, basically said he hadn't heard from anyone in Britain that they had felt especially patriotic watching it, and possibly because Brexit has soured the national mood among liberals there the same way it has here. So that was kind of an interesting idea that, like, if you're British, you might not be stirred in the same way because it's tough times there. Like, I think if I saw... You know, I mean, when we saw Hacksaw Ridge this time last year, it was kind of overwhelming in the same way. So I don't know, maybe that won't even be the same pull that it would be. But it made me want to, like, wave a Union Jack and, you know, pledge allegiance to the Queen.
I mean, it should be, you could almost call this movie Stiff Upper Lip.
You know, oh, really, absolutely. It's just,
that's basically the deal.
I love it.
Mark Rylance is so great in everything. I mean, yeah. He does get some room to move.
Mark Rylance is now like the symbol of decency for, you know, if you want that in a movie, you just bring him in and he's quiet decency. And,
right.
Yeah. I feel fine about that. Like, that is our society moving in a good direction for once.
Same.
I do want to give poor Luc Besson and Valerian my bad movie decision one silver lining, which is to say I could see it be in the Oscar race for visual effects. Mm-hmm. It is a visually dazzling film. And it's possible that, like, everyone will want to forget that it ever happened. But, you know, if they want to throw him a bone, it's like a beautiful world, incredibly rendered. It just has nothing to shore it up.
And
so
there was one other, I agree with you, Joanna, completely. It looks amazing. I want people to see it because it's worth seeing. But another sort of mini Oscar whispery narrative that came out of this past weekend was a number two hit, a big hit, was Girls Trip with Tiffany Haddish, who plays the kind of, you know, if we have to make the comparison, like, she's sort of like the Melissa McCarthy in Bridesmaids of Girls Trip.
Right.
And she's wonderful in it, and it's a real breakout performance. She's been in things before, but this is her first really big feature role. And just, you know, a sort of anecdotal survey of Twitter for, like, Tiffany Haddish Oscar, that, like, that sort of at least groundswell grassroots campaign is already in the works. We've talked extensively about, like, how comedy never has a really hard time getting in the Oscars, although supporting actor, that's where it tends to be.
Yeah.
if it is anywhere. So anyway, that could be interesting. I like that campaign. I think she's great in it. She had a wonderful couch interview on Jimmy Kimmel Live last week,
yeah,
where she told this wonderful story about going on a swamp tour with Jada Smith and Will Smith that's hysterical, and everyone should watch it if they haven't. She also has a really great interview on The Breakfast Club, the radio show, where she reveals a lot about her fascinating and troubled past. Anyway, she's just...
And a good one with our own Johanna Desta.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
The Hollywood section. Well, it would be interesting if what we ended up from this weekend was really Mark Rylance in supporting actor and Tiffany Haddish in supporting actress. That would be fine.
I would happily endorse that, yeah.
And then we can get them in a movie together.
It's too bad that NBC canceled Carmichael show just weeks ago, I think, which was, you know, she was on and she was great on, and that was a great struggling show, and now her star is rapidly on the rise. I mean, it'll free her up to do more things, but that show could have used her, like, her shine that she's getting off of this, you know. So,
well, Mike and Molly stayed on the air forever after Melissa McCarthy got an Oscar nomination, and I don't think it did anybody any good, so maybe she's
but Mike and Molly's a not a good show, and Carmichael show was a great show. True. So, you know.
Yeah, I think that'll be a fun thing to take. You know, while we're focused on Detroit and Dunkirk as kind of the more obvious Oscar contenders, having a Tiffany Haddish campaign to start up, why not?
I still want Get Out to not be forgotten, too. I don't think it will.
I don't think it's in danger of that.
I think it's going to be like the Stranger Things of... where you kind of think, like, that's way too early, but it'll stick. It'll stick around.
A friend of mine suggested that they'll re-release it in theaters around Halloween. It's like a horror movie effort, and then have that also be its FYC campaign.
That seemed pretty smart to me.
Well, while we've been recording this episode, the Toronto Film Festival has announced its first wave of programming for this year's festival, which we'll be covering once again. And as usual, there is a huge, amazing list of exciting fall movies on there. So, Richard, what's sticking out to you?
Oh boy, so much. I mean, as ever, Toronto is a jam-packed festival, but, and a couple of these I already knew about because, I don't know, I had a little bird tell me.
Because you're fancy.
Yeah. No, because I wrote a little thing for the upcoming issue of the magazine, so I had to get a little preview for that. A couple things I'm really excited about. Mother, the Darren Aronofsky movie with Jennifer Lawrence. I'm really excited for Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, which is the movie with Frances McDormand, written and directed by Martin McDonagh, who did In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths, a very underrated movie. George Clooney's next directorial effort, Suburbicon. Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. There was one other. oh, I'm really excited for other people to see Call Me By Your Name and to see how that movie's sort of Oscar chances start to take shape when more people see it in Toronto. A movie I loved at a Sundance, and I think a lot of other people will fall in love with. But that's just a minor sampling. There's so much more.
So Greta Gerwig and Andy Serkis are directors now?
Yeah.
And that's cool. And we got an Alexander Payne here, downsizing.
Yeah.
I'm like really distressed that we've gone this far without mentioning I, Tanya,
Thank
starring
you.
Margot Robbie
Thank
as Tanya you. Harding.
Yeah, if we're going to relitigate all the scandals of the 90s, I, Tanya, I feel like has to be made, and I'm really excited about it. I also just want to shout out The Darkest Hour, the Joe Wright movie about Winston Churchill, which released a pretty dreadful looking trailer a little while ago, but I stand for Joe Wright in all things, and I'm holding out hope for it.
Could be big for Gary Oldman.
Yes. I mean, I think if nothing else, Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill is going to be amazing. I think Ben Mendelsohn's playing King George the fifth,
yeah.
whichever one Colin Firth played in the King's Speech.
That's right.
Who's so, yeah, now great cast.
I think you mean Jared Harris played in The Crown.
Thank you very much.
He's been played by so many different actors at this point, just in the past 10 years. Something I wrote about in this little piece that's going to be in the magazine was Stronger, the David Gordon Green movie about, not specifically about the bombing itself, but sort of the aftermath of the Marathon Boston bombing, based on a true story about a guy who lost his legs and, you know, sort of his overcoming of that with Jake Gyllenhaal and Tatiana Maslany. Normally, this might seem like a sort of schmaltzy, you know, whatever kind of movie that doesn't catch the attention of awards voters. But, you know, David Gordon Green is a really interesting, talented director. Gyllenhaal has been scratching at that Oscar door for a long time. And maybe this could be it. Maybe Tatiana Maslany could be something. So I think it's interesting that that was one of the movies that the people at TIFF decided to share with me when I was writing this article. So yeah, I'm curious about that.
Mudbound. They're not going to give up on Mudbound.
No, we'll see where that
goes. Dee Reese, who I interviewed at a screening recently, I want her to come on the show. She is so cool.
Yeah,
and that's another intense film, but good.
Yeah, and a movie that I'm rooting for. I think a lot of people are rooting for.
You know what? I just found on the list is it's listed as untitled Bryan Cranston Kevin Hart film, but I believe that's a remake of the French film Intouchables.
Yes, you are right.
Oh.
Which was a huge, huge hit.
Ew.
Yeah, it's a pretty sentimental movie. I'm not really sure what to expect from it, but the combination of Kevin Hart and Bryan Cranston at a TIFF gala is fascinating.
That's your The Butler of this year.
And we would be remiss not to mention that the queen herself, Angelina Jolie, has a movie there that she directed called First They Killed My Father, about the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, that is based on a true story, I think, but I think it is a scripted film and it's not a documentary. So she's always, you know, always interesting to see what she does. But yeah, it's exciting. I mean, it's crazy that we're now at this like fall movie season almost again, but we'll have so much to talk about.
That's right.
Weren't we just talking about The Light Between Oceans and Flores Foster Jenkins on the show?
Hey, and shout out to Maggie Betts, whom I know personally through friends, with Novitiate in there. That's great.
And Novitiate's one we really should keep an eye on, because Melissa Leo has a crazy good performance in that as this like really hectoring mother superior that's, I think, an absolute supporting actress contender. There is one scene where she's lying prostrate on an altar screaming at the heavens that is really magnificent.
This conversation is more prepped than I usually do until I'm like actually on the plane to Toronto, so thank you guys for this. This is very helpful.
And Richard, you'll be at Toronto as well as at the Telluride Film Festival, which happens a few days before Toronto and presumably will feature a lot of these titles, but they don't announce their lineup until a few days before.
I already might know a few.
The suspense continues. Mm-hmm.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So Comic-Con was over the weekend. Joanna, you did some really heroic coverage for it for VF.com. There was a lot going on. And, you know, probably a lot of big upcoming things that we could talk about. But the narrative that I kind of found the most interesting to watch was what happened after this Hollywood Reporter article broke on Friday saying that Warner Brothers was considering getting rid of Ben Affleck as Batman, and he might not even play him in the standalone movie that Matt Reeves is directing. And then Ben Affleck had to go to Comic-Con and sit in front of thousands of people and say, "I love being Batman. Everything is doing just fine here." Do any of us believe that he is going to stick around? Like, doesn't it kind of seem like the writing's on the wall for him and he now just has to make a graceful exit after Justice League?
Well, so he's contracted for 3 movies, right? I believe. And so that would be Batman v Superman and the 2 Justice League movies. And then his contract would be done. I think the most popular theory is that, you know, there are some Batman stories where the Bruce Wayne version of Batman actually becomes more of like an advisor figure to a younger Batman character who takes up the mantle. And so the common thought among those comic book nerds is that Affleck will move into that, and so he would sort of cameo or something like that, which is a more graceful way to leave than just to shove him out. The odder sub-narrative of this is the whole Ben Affleck too old to play Batman question, which I thought was kind of weird and mean-spirited that came out of all of that. I mean, maybe it's true.
The line in the Hollywood Reporter was like, his body isn't exactly a temple, yeah. Which is like, okay, yeah. What did you eat lately?
It's pretty rough. So, yeah, I don't know. I would be interested in seeing something like a Batman Beyond storyline, only because it would be something different. Like this Justice League thing, the thing about the Marvel movies is, you know, for all their repetitiveness, they're bringing up a bunch of characters that we've never seen on the screen, like Ant-Man or what have you, you know. Whereas with Justice League, the Batman Superman retread is just like, it's so boring in my mind. And so if we have someone as talented as Matt Reeves making a Batman movie, I would love for that to be something very different from anything we've seen from Nolan or Burton before him, or Schumacher. You know, to make it a non-Bruce Wayne Batman, I think would be very interesting. But I mean, I don't know. I don't know if there's like how much indignity is attached to Affleck being removed as director, being like his script being thrown out, like all of that stuff that's happening. I couldn't tell watching him at Comic-Con whether or not he was personally wounded by all these things that were going on or what.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to really read into it. Like, I feel like him being removed as director also could have easily just been him kind of deciding it wasn't worth his time. But, like, Mike and Richard, when you look at Ben Affleck, and, you know, regardless of what you think about Justice League movies, like, it feels weird to have a giant star who was this Oscar darling 5 years ago wind up here, doesn't it? It didn't seem like it was going to work out this way for Ben Affleck.
Well, I mean, he's had such a strange kind of topsy-turvy roller coaster career, hasn't he? I mean, he had like 2 big peaks of his career early and then sort of post Argo or surrounding that, you know, The Town and Gone Baby Gone. I'm sort of used to this narrative with him where he's up and then he's down and he's kind of in a trough right now. But is he really? Because, I mean, nothing really has happened yet. You know, this has all been speculation. His turn as Batman was fine and the movie did well enough and, you know, all this. So in kind of a broader narrative about Ben Affleck's career, it's not that surprising. What is surprising to me is that if you believe the rumors that Warner Brothers and DC would be so willing to change ships midstream like this when they're really just starting to build this whole thing out. You know, it's not like it's 5 years down the road.
Nothing's ever easy for Ben Affleck, right? Even like his Oscar is for what it's for Best Picture, but he was blanked out of Best Director. I can't remember anymore, but it's like it's not for acting.
Yeah.
That was the year where he was kind of snubbed and then won the whole thing.
Yeah, he wasn't even nominated.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, you know, I've seen this guy on a couple of Oscar nights and it's always like, you know, you see the effort, he wears the effort on his sleeve at all times, you know? So, but it is interesting, I mean, because people talk a lot about female Oscar winners and how that can be almost like a trap where they're afraid to take sort of a lower brow role and then highbrow roles don't materialize and you end up with no career. You kind of like disappear. Does it function quite the same way for men? I'm not sure. Clearly, in this case, it wasn't, you know, Ben's always got some angle he's working and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, I think. What's funny to me is that he cares a lot about this stuff. He's not like, this is not a guy who's like, wait, you know, checking out a few scripts and like letting his agent tell him what to do. I mean, he's really working all day trying to figure out how to like get to the next level.
Yeah. And I think that also that something that has sort of plagued him since he sort of first burst on the scene 20 years ago was when he became famous as an actor, it didn't take very long until he sort of veered into these like bad vanity projects. Not that he was making them, but like that he was playing these sort of like cool hero guys, you know, when he was sort of maybe more of a character actor, I don't know. But then even with his directing, where his most recent film Live by Night, I mean, not many people saw that movie, but if you do, I mean, it is this really crazy vanity project where it really only took one film after Argo for him to go a little bit overboard with the sort of self-mythologizing, you know, and yeah. That's an impulse that many actors and many directors have. It's not just a knock on him. It's sort of a problem that creative people have. But right. He just...
Whereas it was starting with Good Will Hunting and then The Town, it's like the guy, you were like, wow, he can do it. And yeah. It's like,
Well, I was going to bring up Live by Night because I really feel like we can't discount how much of that is involved in this Batman narrative, because the story coming out of Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, was like, this is a shit show. But everyone was like, but Ben Affleck's Batman was good, and it seemed like the future of the Justice League was pinned on the idea that Ben Affleck's Batman is good, and he's going to get his own movie, and we're going to put him in, you know.
And he was going to direct
He's going to
like
direct
a talented
it.
Talented director was going to direct himself as Batman.
Yeah, like this is going to be a whole thing, and nothing in, I mean, he was in Suicide Squad, but barely, so that didn't really, like, ding him at all. But, like, there hasn't been a subsequent bad Batman performance for him. So I really feel like this narrative shifted because of, you know, because Live by Night was also a Warner Brothers movie. And so, like, whatever badness happened with that, I feel like that has to be involved in all of this. And then, of course, the other thing that happened, like, if they pivot the franchise to pin it more on Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman, that makes good business sense to me. I don't know if they'll do that. They've already pivoted the marketing for Justice League to be more about her. But, like, since she's so beloved by fans, critically supported, and made a crap ton of money with her standalone film, it would make sense that she would sort of enter the center of the spotlight there.
So, Joanna, do you think Warner Brothers is responding to like market research about the audience just being like, we're kind of meh on Ben Affleck at best? Or do you think it's literally just like, oh, he made a different movie and it bombed, so even though Argo was Best Picture winner and a huge hit, we don't care anymore?
Or not, we don't care. It bombed and we don't care. We don't know the whole story of like what happened with that movie, but you know, if Richard's perception is accurate that it's sort of a crazy vanity project, maybe they're like, we don't trust him with this franchise that's already shaky. Like, we don't trust what Ben Affleck is going to do given the last thing that he did for us, despite Argo or The Town. And so we're going to give it to Matt Reeves, who's got this more solid track record of blockbusters over here. And like, maybe, never mind, I'm fanficking at that point. I'm like, maybe Ben Affleck got mad about that. So they're like, fine, you won't be our Batman at all. Like, I don't know. I don't know what happened, but
this,
you know.
This would make a good Ryan Murphy
series.
Affleck
is the only... He is the only established celebrity currently in this Justice League universe, and we've talked about how at Marvel they kind of find new young actors for cheap. They turn Chris's into movie stars. They started with Robert Downey Jr. He's kind of the linchpin of the franchise, and it seems like Ben Affleck was going to go that way too. But the way that these franchises are moving is that you hire young talent who doesn't cost anything, and it's possible that like Ben Affleck is just expensive to be in this role, and like maybe they would rather just, you know, find a 25-year-old who doesn't cost anything
to play Nightwing. I'd watch it. I really do want Matt Reeves to make a Batman Beyond movie with cameos from Ben Affleck, so it's not super awkward. Only mildly awkward. Actually, but then Ben Affleck would have to go on that publicity tour, so maybe not. I don't know.
It's also worth saying that Justice League is kind of a mess for reasons that have nothing to do with Ben Affleck and kind of nothing to do with anyone. Like, it just seems cursed in some odd way. Like, it was, you know, coming off of Batman vs. Superman, it was having a hard time, and then Zack Snyder walked away for personal reasons, so now Joss Whedon's finishing it, and there was a report yesterday about how they're having, like, $25 million worth of reshoots, which isn't unheard of, but is a lot of reshoots. So I don't know. They're like, not, things just don't seem to be lining
up. Well, from
up
the
on this.
From the Comic-Con perspective, you know, when they, the Justice League presentation in hall, you know, every Saturday in the big hall of Comic-Con is bookended by a big lavish presentation in the morning from Warner Brothers and a big lavish presentation at night by Marvel. That's the bookends of like, these are your comic book movies that are coming. Warner's had the actors from Justice League out there. No, I mean, understandably, Zack Snyder wasn't there because, you know, he's got personal things going on. Joss Whedon, who's taken over and hasn't missed a Comic-Con in 22 years, wasn't there. There were no creatives there. It was just like, here are your actors. And then they didn't announce anything about the future of the franchise. Meanwhile, Marvel, sitting high, is like, at the end of the night, is like, bam, we got this. Michelle Pfeiffer's in this now. Blah, blah, blah. We got this. You know, like, they're like, here's our future, and we're super confident. We're setting, Brie Larson's Captain Marvel's going to be in the 90s. We've got all these plans, and we're just on track. And Warner's is like, here are our five actors. Please ask them nice questions. Okay, we're done now. Like, that was
well,
it, you know?
I mean,
and so,
not to just turn every conversation about Warner Brothers into a thing about how Marvel's so much better at what they're doing. doing. But if you think about the Oscars and comic book movies, Marvel has done a really smart job just saying, like, hey, we're going to get a few Oscar-y people to class this joint up. We're going to give them contained roles that really require some great acting. We're not going to necessarily pin the whole franchise on them, and we're not going to let them direct anything. We'll get a director who knows how to make action movies, but like Mark Ruffalo can play the Hulk, and you know Jeremy Renner can play Hawkeye, and if anybody's ever heard of that character, like that's not a huge risk. And Gwyneth Paltrow can play Pepper. You know what I mean? I just think like you can go... It's like you don't want a superhero movie director necessarily directing your Oscar movie, but I'd much rather that than an Oscar-y director directing your superhero movie.
Right.
Well, yeah.
They always say it's easier to go from genre to class than the other direction.
In Warner Brothers' defense, they have the only person who has won an Oscar for a superhero movie at this point. Although that now feels like 100 years ago that The Dark Knight and Nolan was in Batman World.
Oh, yeah. That was a different era, wasn't it?
Wait, did that... Oh, it won an Oscar for Heath Ledger, you mean?
Not that the Dark Knight won an Oscar. I mean, Nolan, if Nolan had agreed to take on Batman as its shepherd, which I'm sure they asked him to do, I don't know, we'd be in a really different situation, I think.
They did.
But
they did.
Like you were saying, Joanna, about the competing presentations at Comic-Con, I mean, just from an outsider's perspective, just looking at Twitter when all these the trailers were dropping and stuff like that, you know, Justice League released a new trailer. It wasn't, you know, we'd seen footage of the film before, but, you know, it was a new cut or it showed more things or whatever. And then Thor Ragnarok, a new one trailer came out for that hours later, you know, and I just feel like that Thor overshadowed it, you know. So it's like this thing constantly is having these moments of the Justice League franchise where it just can't quite
right.
Get, you know.
The thing that really strikes me, I mean, I'm not like a detective. I don't know exactly what's going on behind the scenes of like what determines who's in Hall H or not. But I've been in two previous Warner Brothers panels and like they brought out their whole raft of directors that they were going to use for the Justice League, half of which are not employed by them anymore at one point. You know, like they're like, these are our new directors and paraded them out. And like, you know, half of them dropped off the projects. I remember... David Ayer was out there pumping up like Suicide Squad and he was like, fuck Marvel, fuck this. Like he was just like, he was making it this big like turf war and it was crazy and everyone was screaming and like, it was this weird like cult of Warner's thing and cults of Justice League thing that was happening. I was freaked out. And so they're like relatively quiet appearance despite the huge Wonder Woman thing. And like the biggest news that came out of Warner Brothers was this like adorable fan reaction, like fan interaction that Gal Gadot had with like a young girl dressed as Wonder Woman. Like that was the Warner's news out of Comic-Con. And so like, I guess the bottom line is the more they can pivot on her, who's like their best hope, and not Ben Affleck, I guess, who, what did he do wrong? I don't know, but apparently something.
Has Patty Jenkins signed her deal for Wonder Woman 2 yet?
I have no idea if that was like part of her original thing or not.
Oh, I just found a Jezebel headline from yesterday that says, it's pretty strange that Patty Jenkins is still not signed on for the Wonder Woman sequel.
That is pretty strange.
Yeah, they got to get moving on that. The thing that people want is more Wonder Woman. So hopefully that happens soon.
Yeah.
Well, we'll keep an eye out for Justice League, which is coming out really soon, given that it's still filming, and see what happens to poor Ben Affleck. That does it for this week's podcast. Thanks for listening. And as always, find us on Apple Podcasts where you can rate and review us and tell other people to listen. As you heard, the Toronto lineup is out. The time is about to come for lots and lots of Oscar buzz, so it's a great time to join us. You can find us all at vanityfair.com, writing about things like the Toronto lineup and Comic-Con. We're all on Twitter at Little Gold Men. And individually, I'm at Katie Rich. Joanna.
Joe wrote this.
Richard.
Rylos.
And Mike had to leave, but he's at Mike_Hogan. This episode was produced by Jordan Bell and edited by Jennifer Lai, and thanks to Andy Bowers at Panoply. And this week's award for the best possible outcome for the current spat between Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions goes to Mike Hogan.
This would make a good Ryan Murphy series.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.